Some of the students who wish to work with me come to me and literally use the language of a star. I want to be a star like you, that kind of thing. When I was starting out my work, there was no indication that I should pursue this particular agenda and that doing so would grant me tenure and some kind of stardom. I chose to do it because I was motivated by what I was seeing in the world around me and what I felt driven and maybe like I really had no choice. This is what I had to do. And that's a different calling and path than looking for something that will get me fame in the academic world or in the public health world. And I would actually strongly discourage those students from pursuing something for that motivation alone, if what they were trying to do was to follow what I would, Chandra's way. So Chandra's way would prefer to be a grain of sand on the beach with an uncountable infinite number of other grains as we collectively, move with the waves of the ocean towards something better.
Welcome. I'm David Castro, board member of the Alliance of Leadership Fellows. Today, the Alliance is excited to continue a series of national conversations engaging leaders at the frontiers of social justice. Our conversation today engages the 2023 winners of the Russell Mauby Award, Dr. Ed O'Neill and Dr. Chandra Ford. The Russell Mauby Award for People Helping People is given every other year in recognition of ongoing contributions to the health and well-being of communities. Our program, which is called Talk That Walks, convenes frontline leaders at the critical place where thought becomes change. The leaders in today's dialogue inhabit the transition point where experience and insight take flight as impactful action. To learn more about the vision and mission of the Alliance, visit us on the web at allianceofleadershipfellows.org. I am passing the baton now to Barbara Krimgold, who served on the selection panel for this year's Mauby Award. Barbara is the founding president of the Culture of Health Equity Network at the Institute for Alternative Futures, or IAF, where she is also the senior health program director. In addition, she serves as a health and social policy expert for the Resilient Cities Social Equity Project, piloting projects in Boston, Massachusetts, and Athens, Greece, supported by the Bertelsmann Foundation, the German Marshall Fund, the Soros Open Societies Institute, and the Rockefeller Foundation's 100 Resilient Cities. She directed the Kaiser Permanente Birch Minority Leadership Development Program and helped design the new Robert Wood Johnson Foundation Human Capital and Leadership Development Program at the IAF. Prior to joining the IAF, Barbara was the director of the W.K. Kellogg Foundation's postdoctoral Kellogg Health Scholars Program at the Center for Advancing Health, a Washington, D.C.-based nonprofit organization dedicated to translating health research into policy and practice. Barbara will be your guide for the rest of this program.
Hi, I'm Barbara Krimgold, and I'm here today to interview the 2023 Russell G. Mauby awardees, Dr. Chandra Ford and Dr. Ed O'Neill. It's my pleasure to have them both here today to start a dialogue about the Mauby program and the purposes of that and their participation in people helping people. To introduce them, first of all, Dr. Chandra Ford is a professor in the Department of African American Studies at the Fielding School of Public Health at Emory. Okay, Dr. Chandra Ford recently joined as a professor in the Department of African American Studies, and she's also a professor of behavioral, social, and health education with a focus on the persistent and pernicious impact of racism on individual and population health. Dr. Ed O'Neill is a physician, an emergency services physician from who trained at St. Elizabeth's Medical Center in Boston and is an ER professor at Tufts University. They'll both be talking with us. They are the recent awardees of the Russell G. Mauby Awards. I'm pleased to have served on that committee and very proud of the awardees that have been selected. I'd like to kick off the conversation with a question to Dr. Chandra Ford. Chandra, when we met, you were finishing up your doctorate at Columbia University and were a Kellogg Scholar and a Kaiser Permanente Leadership Development Awardee while you were at UCLA, where you were awarded tenure and a prestigious NIH R01 award. You were the first Kellogg Scholar in our Kellogg Health Scholars program of 150 scholars to get this prestigious R01 award from NIH. So I just wanted you to start us off by telling us how you got started in your field and how you found your specialty.
Thank you so much for that introduction. And I also want to thank the Alliance for Fellowship Leaders, Leadership Fellows. I did not realize I was the first, and I think that or among the first, and I just feel like it's a real privilege because the Kellogg Scholars Program was just such a profound impact on my career and making me feel very committed to doing the hard work of social justice in public health in ways that also can affect policy. I'm not exactly sure why I have focused on racism exactly. When I first started college, I actually had no intention of doing anything except maybe learning multiple international languages and being a journalist, or maybe doing forestry. And I found myself, however, experiencing so many forms of racism just in my day-to-day life on campus that it led me, in order to survive that experience, to basically dissociate from the pain, to just intellectualize it. And I have been profoundly interested in understanding how othering and structural injustices influence the well-being of various marginalized communities. And so that was more than two decades ago. And we see that these forms of othering continue to affect us in so many different ways. And it has propelled me to do this work.
Great. I'm pleased to see it looks like your work has taken hold. I know when you were at UCLA, you founded the Center for the Study of Racism, Social Justice, and Health, and brought a lot of new science to UCLA in that area. And recently, I saw that you also were made the lead editor of journal Racism Scientific Tools for the Public Health Professionals. Can you tell us about that, the founding of that journal?
Yes. So this is actually a published book with many different contributors. The first edition of the book was published in 2019, right before the pandemic. And we were really concerned. We editors were concerned because we thought we've been interested in studying racism for quite a while, and this is the work we do within public health, but nobody is going to be interested in reading this stuff beyond this very brief period of time. So in 2018, when we were working on the book, we actually thought we have to hurry and get this book published because after this, you know, a few months, maybe a year, people will lose interest in racism as a public health problem. We had no way of knowing that, in fact, it would become more salient now than we could have ever imagined then. So the book is intended not to be a who's who of academic researchers doing work on racism and health. The book is intended to translate all of that science so that frontline public health professionals, many of them really eager to actually do something about racism, have some concrete guidance on what exactly it is that they should be doing. So it's a real privilege to do the work. It's very humbling to do that work. And I hope it's also very applied and practical. I have the privilege now to be working with Derek Griffith. We are going to be publishing a second edition of the book next year. Next year will be 5 years since the first edition. And so the second edition will be published next year.
Well, congratulations on that. I'd like to add into the conversation now. And so we can move forward with both of you giving us a bit of your history, which is helpful. Ed, I know that you knew Russ Mauby, you mentioned, and have been a long time participant in the Alliance of Leadership Fellows, which Chandra mentioned, is the association that has convened a committee and selected the two of you as nominees for this year's prize. I understand you've had 25 years working in social justice and cooperation in the public health area, and that you founded OmniMed to help provide opportunities for volunteers to do work in global health. You've also written a practical guide for global health services. So I wondered if you could get us started by telling us how about the development of OmniMed and your role in that.
Certainly. Thank you, Barbara. And I just want to say to Dr. Ford, I'm a huge admirer. What you write about and what you do is just so critically important. As a health provider in the ER, in the trenches on a daily basis, I see what you write about. And I am constantly teaching our students the importance of it. And we really need to understand underlying causation and get to the root cause of why we see these disparities. And it's really important work. So I commend you on what you do. A few things just to break down, Barbara. I wrote a book called Awakening Hippocrates in 2005. And there is a chapter on history and racism and just how that leads to our disparities. So again, this is a subject that's been long important and near and dear to my heart. But my background in the realm of working internationally goes back to 1987. I worked in a mission hospital in Tanzania with the Medical Mission of Mary as a fourth year medical student, and it just changed my life. I saw disparities there that were shocking. We have incredible disparities here. It's another order of magnitude when you get to some of the poorest countries in the world, which I've spent quite a bit of time in. And that changed my path. And part of it was understanding, part of it was experiential. And when I was a Kellogg Fellow, in the 1980s, I was exposed, 1990s actually, I was exposed to people like Russ Mauby and Roger Sublette and Katherine Johnson and Lessa Phillips and so many other great leaders, and was able to learn from their experiences. And the Kellogg Fellowship gave me the opportunity to write a book on these health inequities, as well as the practical guide. And my life's mission has been to try and get many more health providers and others to have direct experience with inequities in our world. And I find often, and maybe Chandra would recognize some of this as well, people don't see what's immediately in front of them. We're so beaten down by our culture and by the consumerism and what's on the media every day. Taking people out of their comfort zones and plunking them down in situations of intense poverty where you can see those issues up front, it opens your eyes to the racism, the health inequities, the issues that plague our society at home. And that's been my life's mission. We've sent over 300 students, medical, nursing, public health, undergraduate to our programs in various countries in Central America and Sub-Saharan Africa through the years. And that's what we try and do. And as far as a leadership piece, there's been just a lot of lessons that I've learned through the years. I've made as many mistakes as anyone has, And that's how we learn. But there's a lot of resources that I'm sure we can get into this conversation, and a lot of means that I think are really important for the world. And again, I would just add one final thought to this. Climate change is the biggest thing that faces all of us right now. It's destroying us as we speak. And I really think that if you look at the fact that the United States has put 25% of the carbon in the atmosphere, and we are the leading contributor, yet it's the poor and the poorest parts of the world that are going to receive the brunt of the change that's spawning these refugee movements and some of the issues we're seeing right now. We have to respond to this, and plunking people down into settings like we're doing in Uganda, exposing to what's there is really important now, as much as ever.
I really appreciate how you, your pathway, Ed. I personally shared a bit about my own. I lived in France, the Philippines, Indonesia, and Ghana as part of the Foreign Service. And it was that background that inspired me to connect the work in the U.S. with the social determinants of health and health equity with global health inequities as well. And I was pleased to be able to take Kellogg Scholars with Kellogg support to countries like Colombia and Mexico and Ethiopia and for various conferences on health equity and for the World Congress of Public Health Associations. So yeah. I think it's really mind-changing for young people to have an experience in another country, and it can deeply influence, as the Peace Corps did, the rest of people's lives.
Sure.
Yeah. And I thought, I wondered if, Chandra, I might ask you, each of you, sort of what you found the most satisfying parts of your own work.
Go ahead, Chandra.
Well, Ed, thank you. Also, I just want to thank you for the work that you do and salute you. You're so right about the life-changing nature of stepping outside of our own, you know, comfort zone to learn from others. The question again, Barbara?
What have you found the most satisfying elements of the work you're doing? What just sort of joy and satisfaction in your work?
I find that my work is very difficult, and that there's a lot that's actually not satisfying. And so let me tell you something that happened to me yesterday. Yesterday, I got a call from a former postdoc who told me that she and a number of students who had been core members of the Center for the Study of Racism, Social Justice, and Health were undertaking a number of projects together. Projects that I myself had been thinking, I wish I could do such and such a project if only I had the time. And in that moment, I literally felt like I might start to cry, because I realized that the effort that I had invested for so many years, and as you both know, the work is really thankless work in many ways, that actually, yes, something had happened. There had been work and there had been results. And in that conversation, I came to realize that and to just really appreciate it. So I think those little conversations where you realize you're touching someone else's heart, someone else's life, those are the most rewarding elements of it for me. I'm really curious to hear what you have to say, Ed.
Yeah, I'd like Ed for you to have a chance to respond to that as well.
And, yes, thank you.
Perhaps you can also include, and Chandra later as well, some of the challenges you've had and how you overcame those or how they remain barriers, but all of those.
Yeah, sure. But to just start with the first piece, I guess I'd answer that on three levels. So one is just the personal direct. In Uganda, for 15 years, we've been training community health workers. And these are people that are very, very poor. They're unpaid. But meeting with them and talking with them and teaching and training them. Just some of the stories that I see, the passion, the dedication, the conviction to the work, just what they do is so inspirational. And I always leave Uganda when I'm there. I'm there a couple of weeks a year, and I always leave just so inspired by how much they give to each other. That's one level. Second, from a programmatic level, just as we have conversations with our staff, I mean, thank God for Skype and for WhatsApp and technologies now. We can communicate so much more efficiently than when I started this back in 1987, my first experience overseas. But just the conversation this morning, the mental health program that we started 2 years ago, started by Lex von Hapten, one of my medical school classmates. We've now reached out into communities, bringing a mental health program that's new called Seek GSP. And we're unearthing patients that have been suicidal, a lot of domestic violence, and for the first time they can actually share it and are making enormous strides and progress. So it's always nice to see the more macro level programs work. And we have a number of those through the years. And then finally, if I could say one word for the people that we send and the reason why I primarily do this, it's transformation. We send people to Uganda in a site in a very tightly regulated program that has a measurable impact, and we expose them. They're out with our staff every day. They see things, and their minds and eyes and hearts are opened, and they transform. They become different people. We see them come back, see the world differently, and we see the career paths change as well. And when you look at what just the importance of Chandra's work, when people come back from an experience overseas, again, they start to see disparities in their own communities. And again, then maybe somebody who would go over and not have an interest in what Chandra and her group are doing, which is so important, they might come back and say, wow, she's right. Let me look more into that. So transforming people has been at the heart of what we've been doing. And it's, I find it so inspirational. It's so much fun to talk to people. I interviewed a student yesterday, and I'm always just really excited by hearing the stories and seeing the change and really listening. And I talk to people while they're in country now too with technology. So it really is. The transformation is what I think one of the most powerful forces in the world. You look at leaders like Lincoln and, you know, so many others that were and King, who really understood the power of transformational change. We see it on the personal level all the time.
And Chandra, circling back to you, would you like to say anything more about, you mentioned the challenges and whether there are some of those that you have figured out ways to overcome or get around, or some that still remain in place for the next leaders we're passing the baton on to grapple with?
You know, I think one of the big challenges is daring to do things differently. Sometimes that means, and perhaps even often that means, walking against the grain to try to advance health equity, speaking truth to power can be challenging. How do we learn to do that in ways that are respectful and that bring people along rather than that are divisive and shut things down? Those are perpetual challenges. Finding support for the work when it's not politically comfortable is also very challenging. There is also something about succeeding in meeting each challenge that comes up with respect to these kinds of challenges that is also rewarding, to have overcome one of those or found a collaborator or a partner or manage to navigate through them. It brings its own set of rewards. So those are the challenges, but they are not barriers. I believe they are challenges that we can always continue to navigate our ways through.
And Ed, anything you'd like to comment on in that vein? I'm sure doing international work has its share of challenges and bureaucratic issues to be overcome. to make sure you can get everything.
Yeah, I can certainly relate to that. We've been an organization on a shoestring budget for 25 years, and it's always a challenge. We've had a persistent series of challenges, but you know, since I think the conversation is around leadership and the basis of the Alliance of Leadership Fellows, you know, I think some of the lessons I've learned through the years are really just persistence and grit and continuing on through this. That's a really important thing, and as well as really empowering the people in our staff in Uganda. I always tell people, this is your program, it's your model. I don't make the decisions. I help to facilitate things, but it is really locally led and run. But yeah, the challenges are many. International work has a lot of challenges. There are issues in Uganda right now where people that are LGBTQ are not tolerated at all. In fact, it's against the law for people to be in same-sex relationships. That's a real difficult issue. It's horrible, and it's unfortunately perpetrated from finances that come from this side. But you know, there's always things that we are confronted with, but I do find, at least in the long run, it's example and its character. And one of my favorite quotes from this work really comes from Albert Schweitzer, who was one of my heroes, one of the early influences. And he said, in influencing others, example isn't the main thing, it's the only thing. And I really do think when we look at our environment and the political landscape now, you look at even what's going on nationally, character is destiny. And we've seen that so clearly. But I do think with a mission-focused organization, which we have, with direction that is very clear, set by those in the field where the information is always coming in, I think that's a really important thing for people moving forward. You really have to have that local leadership and design, and it has to be mission-focused with a real emphasis on larger transformational change based on values proposition. So I know Jim Kim and Paul Farmer, who are two friends and lead influences, always talked about first principles. And in, I think, both international work like we do, as well as domestically, those first principles are just so important. You know, your character, look at inclusivity and understanding and compassion. And those are really key elements that we're seeing, unfortunately, really being pushed aside by major forces in our world. So it's more incumbent upon us than ever before to lead with character and lead with quality and compassion. And you know, I hope that we can persist through what we're seeing now nationally. I hope things don't come out okay next year.
Those were certainly really very impressive previous MAUBE awardees, Paul Farmer and Jim Kim. And I
Yeah.
had a chance to spend some time with Paul Farmer and also to hear Ophelia Dahl, his partner, started the program, speak about the development of their partner's program. And they did very impressive work. And Jim Kim certainly made his name as or became widely known, I guess, in the DC area with his work at the World Bank. So you're in excellent company. But
Absolutely.
since they were awardees, we've had a number of new issues arise. Chandra mentioned COVID, which has been now 3.5 years. I still am hearing people every day putting their masks back on again because their community has had a large number of people who've come down with the new variant of COVID. Since Jim Kim and Paul Farmer were MAUBE awardees, we've had a number of new issues arise. First of all, the COVID pandemic for 3.5 years now. Certainly, people are catching COVID today. I heard of a number of areas where they put on masks again for 6 months because of the large number catching this variant, which seems to be very transmissible. In addition to that, we've had a really difficult political climate for the last few years. And it remains difficult with new congressional leadership that seems to be going back not just dozens of years, but thousands of years to an earlier reality. And climate change, which is something we've been aware of for decades, had a chance maybe to do more than we did in the 80s, and failed to actually do what we might have been able to do to bring public attention and action to it then. So I'm wondering how those three new issues have affected your work.
Is this for me or for Chandra or for both?
Start out this time, Ed, and then Chandra can follow up.
Yeah, I think I mean it's a very apt question, a very appropriate question for both of us, really. As far as COVID goes, I think COVID did a few things. One is it exposed just how vulnerable our health system is in the United States, and just how poorly designed it is. We don't fund public health in the United States. We did not have the infrastructure in place to respond to COVID. The CDC does not do national incubators and ventilators and masks and vaccination program. We just didn't have the infrastructure in place for it. And the second aspect is touches directly on the importance of Chandra's work, which is the people that get hit hardest by COVID tended to be poor and tended to be people of color. Now, I was in the ER for the entire COVID pandemic, and I still am. A lot of times early on when I was intubating or when I was really working to resuscitate somebody, they didn't speak English. A lot of them, people that were people of color, people that are poor, people that are immigrant, often had jobs where they couldn't work from home, work remotely. And it broke down not just here, but worldwide. It really hit the poorest the hardest. And leading into climate change, the book I'm working on right now is the intersection between COVID and climate change. And those same lessons are there. If, again, as I mentioned early on, we put most of the carbon into the atmosphere, a quarter of it, yet people that are in wealthy countries are going to be able to find ways to protect themselves. If you're on an island in the South Pacific, or if you're in Sub-Saharan Africa or Asia or a very dense populated country, particularly in coastal areas, you're in trouble. We just saw that with Bangladesh last year, with 40% of the country flooded. We saw the heat waves all over the world this year. We saw 50,000 people in Russia killed in 2011, 30,000 people in Europe killed in 2003. We're going to see climate change continue to exact an enormous toll. But it's going to exact a toll along the lines that it always has, that any emergency has, whether it's Katrina hitting New Orleans and 80% of the people that were stuck there and caught were African American, and the relatively wealthier whites were able to escape. Anytime we have an emergency that just exposes the fault lines in our country and in our world, we see the same lessons over and over again. There have always been inequities, and it has always been incumbent upon us, I think, as leaders, to define those inequities and to work, just as Chandra has for so many years so well, to define those inequities and design solutions. How do we get at this? Why are these things as they are? And part of what I've written in Awakening Hippocrates and working on again still is you have to view the world through the lens of how inequality drives and defines things. And again, the COVID pandemic, as well as climate change, is continually exposing these rifts. And I really think it just distresses me when I hear politicians go after critical race theory. And I'm sure Chandra could give an hour on that. I don't know how you would even be able to tolerate just that, how dissonant that must be. But it's so critically important. We have to start by understanding. We have to start by understanding both domestic issues, the inequities, as well as globally. So I think, again, that's COVID and climate change. I'm not sure what the third one was, but I don't want to take up too much more on that. It's just a really important area that if we don't understand inequity, if we don't understand the forces that drive these disparities, you can't possibly hope to fix them. And that's a major problem, particularly with the rise of social media, as we get locked into the news stations that we think tells us the truth, and then the podcast that we only listen to, and we're increasingly siloed and increasingly unaware of the othering, as Chandra had alluded to earlier. But it's really among the most important things in human history and the most important things that we face right now.
Yes, the two COVID The COVID pandemic and climate change. You also addressed the third one, which was political challenges.
That's an hour right there.
Governor who made people believe in the state of Virginia that we were going to be teaching critical race theory to kindergartners, and better watch out. So it's been challenging. It seemed for a while that we had, because of better presidential leadership, we were safe, but we still have a lot going on at a state and local level that is quite concerning.
Yes.
Chandra's in the thick of it. You've been really a target, so I'm sure that figures in your list of challenges in the last 5 years.
It does, but I'm aware that we are in a dangerous moment right now, but I don't feel like we cannot go through it. I have a certain, I don't want to use the word optimism because it sounds a little superficial given the magnitude of the challenges we now face, which and the, you know, just how dire they are. But I also feel like it's very important for us to find a way to connect to the very people who are even science denialists, outright racists, and so forth. And so for me, I try not to simply reject them as somehow, you know, idiots or unthinking, but to really try to stand in their shoes and figure out how they got to where they are. I don't want to overstate. I don't want to put too much. I don't want to set aside the needs of those who are marginalized to over empathize with those who are essentially harming and marginalizing. But I also don't want to simply dismiss or ignore them as if they did not get to their perspectives through some way that's logical, perhaps, to them. So that's been something I have been trying to work on, and it's a hard place to be because it's not a place where many people are, I don't think. And in this moment, I actually feel like there's something, I share so much of what Ed said, and there's also a way for us to be thinking about how focusing on structural drivers, on fundamental causes, on the social determinants of health does not require us to think about each, you know, oh, it's COVID, or is it climate change, or is it a new virus, but really to think about how poverty, social inequalities, and these things drive all of these different things, and they will continue to drive them over time. So understanding these root causes will enable us to be able to respond to whatever emerging specific crisis we face in the future. One thing I really would like us to deal with, particularly in the United States, is what I think of as the limited attention to critical thinking and education. And it seems that so much of what we encounter now is actually tied to, you know, the inability of our general populace to really to engage deeply or to understand basic information that I believe need to be able to understand if we're going to be a knowledgeable and responsible citizenry. And I mean citizenry in the broadest sense of the term, not in terms of passports, but as members of shared communities who have a responsibility to one another.
Some of your comments about overcoming challenges in stereotypes of people reminded me of the excellent work that Henri Treadwell did after she left Kellogg and was at Morehouse on systematic inequities that drive some of the health outcomes that we see, and her work on health inequities among men and boys, and then looking at the criminal justice system for the racial inequities in that system, and working with wardens and other officials of prisons in southern states to have a dialogue about it and increase understanding of how the systemic structures of our systems contributed to those racial inequities. So there's so many aspects of what drives the social, educational, environmental, economic determinants of health. I admire people who bring non-traditional participants into the process and give them new understanding. And that brings me to the question I'd like to ask both of you, which is your advice to emerging change makers.
Well, I wonder if I could just follow on a little bit, because I think what Chandra said is so important. The drivers of what we're seeing in our country right now, to my mind, are largely based in economic inequalities. William Julius Wilson wrote a brilliant book in the 90s, I think it was, called When Work Disappears. And it's all about what happened to communities when the jobs, as they did, went from northern cities to the south and from the south to overseas in the 70s and 80s. And just these drivers of inequality and these a lot of the force that spin off and that come directly from that. So I totally agree with you, Chandra. I'm not looking to go after anybody that has opinions different. In fact, the book that I'm writing now is really targeted to people that are really not really fully understanding. And I saw so much of it during COVID, people refusing to wear masks, refusing to get vaccines. I almost got in a fist fight with one construction worker. Wouldn't put a mask on. And then after a very long conversation, we're able to get some understanding, which is really what we need more of. But anyway, I just think that's a really important point. The drivers of so much of what we're seeing really do come from the fact that our country is doing this. We're getting these disparities that are just widening greatly, as opposed to what we had in the 50s. Not that I want to turn the clock there, but from a solely economic and tax structural standpoint, I would much rather see tax and just the resources distributed in a much more fair way than they are now. What we're doing right now is unsustainable. But anyway, I thought that was important to follow up. But anyway, Sean, if you want to go ahead and start with Barbara's question first, please be my guest.
Certainly the economy is a major driver. And I just have been reading recently Angus Deaton's new book, As a Scottish Immigrant, on an immigrant's view of inequality in America. Just his amazement at the width of the gap in the last few decades that he's been living in this country, and some of the initial resistance among economists and in the U.S. to grapple with that as a driver.
Right.
And Chandra, give you a chance to respond as well.
So you asked, what would we share with emerging scholars, researchers, leaders? There are many things to share. I'm just going to share a very Chandra thing to share. Some of the students who wish to work with me come to me and literally use the language of a star. I want to be a star like you, that kind of thing. When I was starting out my work, there was no indication that I should pursue this particular agenda and that doing so would grant me tenure and some kind of stardom. I chose to do it because I was motivated by what I was seeing in the world around me and what I felt driven and maybe like I really had no choice. This is what I had to do. And that's a different calling and path than looking for something that will get me fame in the academic world or in the public health world. And I would actually strongly discourage those students from pursuing something for that motivation alone, if what they were trying to do was to follow what I would, Chandra's way. So Chandra's way would prefer to be a grain of sand on the beach with an uncountable infinite number of other grains as we collectively, you know, move with the waves of the ocean towards something better. Not, and granted, this may come in part from my experience living in LA, where I become very familiar with the quote unquote industry, not a star that looks disconnected from everyone else, but part of a collectivity. I do not believe that one person is going to solve it all. I believe that we have to have faith in what others around us can do. And so we have to do our little bit and share it and just allow others to have their role. And so that's what I would say. Pursue what you believe is important for you to do and be willing to share what you can with others so that we can all be collectively involved in whatever ways we can each contribute to this push toward what Martin Luther, Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, referred to as the beloved community.
Thanks, Chandra. And Ed, I think that you might have some final words also to what advice or inspirations you would suggest you would give to emerging change makers and the young leaders.
Yeah, I love Dr. King's quotes, our inescapable mutuality, as he said, as Chandra alluded to. What I try and talk to young people about is I really think it starts with understanding. And again, I think even more so now in a post-COVID world where people are so immersed in social media, hearing the same things over and over again, I have long since tried to get people to work in our site in Uganda, before that was in Belize and Guyana, to really sort of shatter those the bonds that they have to their usual information sources and ways of viewing things. I think it's really important to understand the world. And to understand the world, you have to experience it and you have to get out there. So that's what I've long pushed to do and to get people to do. In terms of getting people to think about things, I try and read this book, Lincoln on Leadership. If people don't know that book, it's a really quick read and a brilliant book by Donald Phillips. I just gave it to one of my colleagues yesterday. There are leadership principles that are, I think, really important. Again, as I mentioned earlier, example is critically important. Character, the way that you compose yourself, the way you act. I think serving others, as Chandra alluded to as well, I would much rather be part of something much larger than stand on a pedestal somewhere. It just doesn't work. Involving people and then getting people to transform through a process of experience is, I think, where our future leaders come from. And if future leaders have to have a clear moral direction that's based on values, and as Jim always said, first principles, and you know, one of the road, fork in the roads that I experienced in my life was Paul Farmer just saying, when my patients tell me they're sick because they're hungry, doesn't it make sense for me to start looking at agrarian policy in the country where I live? And again, shouldn't that force a larger conversation? When we look at life expectancy, the famous study of in Harlem in New England Journal of Medicine in the 80s, I think, where a Black man in Harlem had lower life expectancy than somebody living in Bangladesh at the time. And we still see these enormous disparities. Well, shouldn't that prompt somebody to say, why is it that African Americans are living 6 years less than whites on average, if that's correct currently, Chandra? It should prompt that discussion. And again, we have to have people that have the courage to challenge the standards that are out there and the courage to just investigate and really ask the hard questions. So I encourage people also to consider political office. Because if you look at change, the larger questions that we face are really going to be solved by great leaders. And you can think of Lincoln or Martin Luther King or JFK or and many others. I thought Barack Obama was a great leader as well. But if you look at the future, the answers to many of these questions, whether it's the COVID pandemic and the leadership we didn't experience then, to climate change, and now with the IRA, the leadership we are seeing, the answers to many of these questions fall on leaders that are going into the political sphere to exert influence. And not the only route, but a really important one.
And as we wrap this up, Chandra, you get the last word here with any final comments you have.
I just want to say what a privilege it is to receive this award and also to share this space with Ed. And
you as well.
I feel inspired and motivated to really double down on the work and try to bring more along with me. So thank you.
And I'd like to thank both of you for all the work you do that is being honored here today and by this award. And thank you for taking the time to be with me and the rest of the Alliance for Leadership fellows. And it's been a pleasure to talk with you both today. So thank you so much. I wish you all the best in your futures.
Thank you so much, Barbara. And thank you to the Leadership Alliance as well.
Yes, thank you to the Leadership
Alliance. Thank you.
Thank you, Chandra.
Thank you. Take care.
Okay. Bye-bye now.
On behalf of the Alliance, thank you for joining us today for this important conversation. It's our hope that sharing these ideas will open new pathways to effective action supporting the fragile world we share. Find us on the web and get involved with our work at AllianceOfLeadershipFellows.org.